particulars, Jack had let slip that the London buyer was from Saudi Arabia. "An Arab?" Tommy said to Jack, clenching his fists, not believing what he was hearing. "A Londoner," Jack said, clearing his throat. "Everyone in the Middle East isn't a terrorist, for heaven's sake. He's a finance guy, very successful businessman, and a very successful collector, highly respected." Tommy was enraged. "But he came from oil money, right? And don't tell me he didn't, because you'll be lying." "I have no idea," Jack said. "That's irrelevant. You want to sell on the black market, you don't get to run a credit check and an employment history. He's rich, and he wants the statue, and he's discreet. Bingo." Tommy had practically carried Jack out the front door, not even giving him the courtesy of a lecture about why he, someone who'd lost a wife and countless friends and fellow firefighters on 9/11, couldn't possibly take Middle Eastern oil money in exchange for a Ground Zero artifact from anyone, anytime, ever. He was relieved by the turn of events because it snapped him out of his funk. He'd been crazy to think selling the statue was possible or ethical. He'd meant it when he'd told Jack that it wasn't about money. All he cared about was where the statue ended up because he needed to honor Ronnie's memory. But if he exposed himself, accidentally or on purpose, he'd harm her memory for his kids. And that was the never-ending loop he'd been caught in for weeks. He yawned. He hadn't been sleeping. How to get the statue somewhere safe? For days, Jack had called him hourly, wanting to reopen negotiations, until Tommy finally threatened to call his friends in the police department and turn them both in. "I'll do it, asshole," he told Jack. "Don't think I won't." At least there'd be some honor in being honest. Sinatra lifted his head and whined a little. "What do you say, Mr. S?" He rubbed a few knuckles across Sinatra's head, the place where his skin was a little slack and the fur soft. The dog panted with pleasure. From down the street, he could see Stephanie waving at him. She probably wanted help with her bags. Sinatra started barking at something in the opposite direction. "Shush, boy," Tommy said, looking to see what was agitating the dog. It was a couple. The woman was on crutches, and there was something uneven about her companion's profile. They were walking slowly and looking at house numbers. As they got closer, Tommy couldn't believe what he was seeing. A tall, muscular man with one arm and a long-haired woman with a missing foot walking together down his street. It was his statue come to life. He stood and Sinatra's barks turned to a menacing growl. "Shh!" He picked the dog up and tucked him under one arm to keep him calm. He really needed to get some sleep. He blinked and shook his head a little. Looked again, but his vision hadn't cleared. The statue was still there, and it was coming toward him. He felt lightheaded and looked up at the sky. He didn't know why, what he expected to see up there. He thought for a minute he might faint. What was happening couldn't be happening. He could feel his breaths becoming shallow and then a constriction around his chest, like someone was tightening a belt. The dog scrambled out of his arms and down the stoop and turned to face Tommy, barking in earnest now, scared. "Oh, please," Tommy thought, "not now. Not the heart attack he'd feared. Not while that statue was still in the house." He put a hand on the iron railing to try to steady himself. If the statue was in his house, how was it also walking down the street? Stephanie was yelling his name from one direction. From the other direction, the statue come to life was getting closer. Sweat streamed down his back and his palms were clammy. Sinatra was barking even harder. Holy Jesus, he was dying. He was having a stroke or a heart attack or both. He tried to take a deep breath, but couldn't. "Quiet," he said to Sinatra, but he wasn't sure anything came out. His throat was tight and dry. "Excuse me." Now the statue was in front of him, talking, wanting to climb the stoop. Tommy tried to speak, but his lips wouldn't work. They were coming for him. That's what he was thinking, even though he didn't really understand what he meant. Coming for him. Who? "Hey." The man stepped closer and reached out with his one arm. "You okay, buddy? You don't look so good."
"What's wrong, baby? Why are you so upset?"
Tommy thought the woman was talking to him, but she'd leaned her crutches against the stoop and was trying to soothe Sinatra, who was barking at her outstretched hand. Tommy stared at her missing foot, and then back at the man with one arm. He couldn't tell in that moment if he was hallucinating or if he was dying, but whichever it was, he knew it wasn't good. "Ronnie," he thought, "help." "Call 911, Tommy heard the man say. "Do you need a hand there, mister? What's your name?" Vinny's voice sounded like it was coming through a long tunnel or across a static-filled connection. He couldn't make out the words, but he heard the man say something about 9/11. Fuck. And right before Tommy pitched forward, he looked at them both beseechingly, his hand at his heart, his mouth a tight slash of pain. "What?" Matilda said, her voice thick with concern and fear. "What is it, puppy?"
"Forgive me," Tommy said, and then he fell, landing at Matilda's missing foot.
Chapter 42. Tomorrow was Mother's Day, and Melody would wake up and spend the last day in her beloved house. Monday morning, the moving truck would come and load all the boxes and wrap their furniture in quilted moving blankets, and they would get in their car and follow the van to their temporary condo on the other side of the tracks. And then the bulldozers would arrive. Walt had kept that piece of information from her until he couldn't any longer. The person who bought their house was a developer who planned to raze the entire thing and build a spanking new monstrosity. She moved through the rooms now with a fresh sorrow. Soon they wouldn't even exist. Today they were waiting for a salvage firm to show up. The developer was not only going to demolish her house, but he was going to strip it first. The wood, molding, the oak banister, her painstakingly cared-for heart pine living room floor, and sell it all to an architectural salvage firm. Walt tried to get Melody to leave, but she wouldn't. She wanted to look the asshole in the eye who was dismantling beauty and reselling it at a profit. She and Nora and Louisa were in the living room packing up the last of the books when the doorbell rang. When Walt opened the door, she thought she was seeing things. It was Jack. She wanted to pummel him at first. She was outraged. He was the salvager. He was going to rip out the soul of her home and sell it. It took a few minutes for Jack and Walter to calm her down and help her understand. Jack was salvaging what he could for her.
"I don't get it," she said.
"I know people," Jack said, gesturing to the crew with him. "These guys will take what you want and store it."
"For what?"
"To use again, Mom," Nora said.
She and Louisa were expectant, excited. They'd known about the plan for weeks as Jack and Walt conspired to figure out the details.
"If you build your own house someday, or to put it in one that's already built, you can keep the best things and reuse them."
"Keep them where?"
"I have a storage unit," Jack said, "a place for backup inventory. If it turns out you don't want the stuff, we can always sell it."
"You guys did this for me?"
Melody was dazed and grateful. "We can only keep what you really want," Jack said. He started organizing everyone. They needed to make a list, figure out what was worth storing, choose the most important things.
"Why don't you guys start upstairs?" Melody said. "I'll make us some tea. The kettle isn't packed yet."
Nora and Louisa ran up the stairs with Walt. "How about the stained glass window in the hall?" she could hear Louisa say. "Mom loves that window." Jack followed her into the kitchen. He looked around the room. "I don't think there's much in here to keep," he said. "These cabinets are from the 70s.
"Jack?"
Melody stood at the sink, filling a kettle with water.
"I don't know how to thank you," she said. "This is..."
"It's what I do. It's easy. But we're paying this crew by the hour, so we should move quickly."
"It won't take long," she said.
She put the kettle on the stove, lit the gas.
"What's going on with Walker?"
Jack shrugged. "Things are getting settled. I handed over my share of the nest, and he made up the difference to pay off my debt. We're selling the house." "He's being generous,"
I won't get half, but I'll get enough to keep the store afloat for a bit, while I figure out whether to sell it or not. He's letting me keep the apartment.
But what's going on between you, other than business?
Jack sat down at the kitchen table. Melody thought he looked thinner than usual, but he seemed better than the last time she'd seen him. How old were you when you got married? He asked.
Barely 22. A baby.
I was 24 when I met Walker. Do you know I've never lived alone? I'm 44 years old and I've never lived alone. The first few weeks Walker was gone, I didn't know what to do with myself. I'd stay in the store until late, pick up some takeout, and just watch television until I fell asleep. Melody looked around the kitchen. She'd spent every night for weeks dismantling their lives and wrapping it in newspaper for packing. Her nails were ragged and black with newsprint. Her arms and shoulders were sore from heaving boxes around.
Sounds kind of great right now.
Jack looked at her and nodded. It is kind of great. That's my point. I miss Walker. I miss him terribly, and I don't know what's going to happen. But for the first time ever, I'm only accountable to myself. And I like it. I'm not proud of why I'm at this point, but I'm doing my best to figure it out, and I'm kind of enjoying it. Parts of it, anyway. Melody wondered what it would be like to live alone. To come home every night and turn on the lights of a darkened house, and have nobody waiting to hear about your day, or eat dinner with you, or argue about which show to watch, or help clear the table. She wouldn't tell Jack how sad it sounded to her. Upstairs, she could hear an electric saw.
I'll be sorry if you and Walker don't get back together, she finally said.
Oh, I'm sure I'll go running and crying back to his capable, meaty arms soon enough. But I doubt he'll have me.
Just then, Walt and the girls came into the kitchen.
Look, Nora said. She had a piece of woodwork in her hand. Melody recognized it immediately. It was from the upstairs hall closet, the piece of wood where she'd recorded the girls' heights at least once a year, red for Nora, blue for Louisa.
This is the first thing I asked for, Nora said.
You did? Melody was pleased that Nora thought to take it because Louisa had always been the more sentimental of the two.
What a perfect idea.
We started a list, Walt said. Look it over and see if you agree.
Someone above them was hammering. The kitchen light fixture swayed a little. Melody looked at the list. It was extensive. She couldn't imagine all those things. Floorboards, windows, banisters, molding, sitting in Jack's storage space gathering dust. A house, but not quite. Bits of a building that didn't add up to a home.
I don't want to keep anything, Melody said.
The room went quiet. Funny, Walt said, laughing, and then stopping when he saw that Melody was serious.
I want that.
Melody pointed to the piece of wood in Nora's hand, marking the years they'd lived there and how much the girls had grown. It was covered with fingerprints and gray with grime because she'd never cleaned that bit, afraid of accidentally smearing or erasing the carefully drawn lines with dates next to them.
That's the only thing I want.
Jack was watching Melody carefully. I don't mind storing things for you, he said.
I know, Melody said. Let's get anything out of here you think is worth money and sell it.
Melody, Walt said, frustrated. I'm confused.
I'm so grateful to you both for thinking of this. Please don't think I'm not grateful. But let's sell it. Use the money to fix up our new place.
You're sure? Walt said.
I'm positive. She turned to Jack. You can sell all this and make a commission, right?
If that's what you want, yes. He was surprised, but pleased. He didn't really have the room to keep everything he'd imagined she'd want to keep.
And you two are okay with this?
She asked Nora and Louisa. She felt good. Lighter. In charge. They both nodded.
We just wanted to do something to make you feel better, Louisa said.
We wanted to make you happy.
I have what makes me happy, she said.
Melody wasn't even sure she understood the impulse making her want to let go, but she decided not to overthink it for once. Having things from the house wasn't the same as having the house. Given all that had happened over the past year, nothing was the same, and it was time to stop holding on for dear life. And just like that, she felt like the general again. Their family might look like they were in retreat, but she knew better. She was the general, and if anything was an advance, this was it.
Chapter 43. It was the craziest thing.
When Matilda would tell the story later, and she and Vinny would tell the story a lot in the coming years, the story of the kiss would be their story, and after the 10th, the 100th, the 1,000th time would still be told in almost exactly the same way, always starting with the same sentence.
It was the craziest thing.
How they went to Brooklyn the day before Mother's Day, and because some adjustments were being done to Vinny's prosthetic arm, he wasn't wearing it, a rare occurrence. How Matilda had fought him about taking the subway, because her stump was particularly painful and she wanted her crutches and was worried about being late. How they'd taken a car service and because there was no traffic had arrived absurdly early. How they'd walked around for a while, admiring the neat blocks of brownstones, the daffodils and pansies in the window boxes, the number of families out on the street pushing strollers, jogging lightly behind kids on bikes with training wheels, planting the tiny garden beds around the tree trunks. How they finally decided to go over to Stephanie's a little early and see if she was home. How the man on the stoop had stood there and stared at them like he was seeing a ghost. How even with one arm, Vinny had caught Tommy O'Toole as he fainted, preventing him from hitting the sidewalk face down and,
God only knows.
Matilda would tell their wide-eyed children then,
God only knows what would have happened if he'd hit his head. If your daddy hadn't caught him, he could have been dead. Worse. His brain could have been damaged and he'd never be the same. But no, your father reached out with one arm and caught him around the waist and set him down like he was no heavier than a big bag of rice, a full-grown man.
Matilda would tell how Stephanie had dropped her bags and flowers and started running down the street when she saw Tommy fall. How she'd sat and cradled his head in her lap and held his hand, and made him stay until the paramedics came and told them he was going to be fine. How they'd finally gotten him to his feet and helped him inside, and then they knew why Tommy had fainted, why seeing Vinny and Matilda on the street had made him dizzy and confused.
It was a statue of Mommy and Daddy.
As soon as Vinny Jr. was old enough to know the story, he'd always interrupt and say that part.
It was a statue of you guys.
That's right.
Matilda would run her hand over his head, his glossy hair dark like his mother's, curly like his father's.
It was a famous statue from France. The lady was missing a foot and the man was missing an arm, just like your mommy and daddy. I took one look at that statue, and I knew.
Here, if Matilda and Vinny were in the same room, she would always pause, always give him the look. A look like she'd given him that day, brimming with awe and revelation. A look that fixed his world and made him whole, and filled him with such unbearable desire and hope that he was always the first to turn away, because the look was almost too much. A virtual sun flooding his world with light.
I saw that statue, Matilda would say, smiling at her boys.
First Victor Jr., then little Fernando, then Arturo for Vinny's grandfather.
And I knew. That statue? It was my sign.
Chapter 44.
Nearly 10 months after the unexpected nor'easter blew through Manhattan in late October, freezing branches, killing 185 stately trees in Central Park, destroying nearly all the autumnal foliage of the five boroughs, including the colorful mums that lined Park Avenue, and the decorative pots of kale the denizens of Brooklyn favored for their front stoops while trying to affect a kind of incongruent country gentility. The birthing centers of New York City were hit with a miniature baby boom. As spring turned to summer and the days grew longer and the humidity crept northward and eastward, slowly making its way up the Jersey Shore until it settled over the city like a clammy, uninvited embrace. The citywide birth rate for July nearly doubled, forcing doctors and nurses and midwives and anesthesiologists to work double shifts, cancel vacations, operate on zero sleep. Snowtober babies, they started calling them. The Ethans and Liams and Isabellas and Chloes that appeared in late July in place of the corn, which had failed to thrive because after that early snowstorm, the rest of the winter was dry as a bone, and the winter's drought extended into spring and summer. But the babies came, their hair as abundant and soft as corn silk, their new bodies unfurling to expose tiny grasping fingers and clenched toes that looked as sweet as newly bared kernels of corn. Stephanie had been having pre-labor contractions for weeks, but she was 5 days past her due date and still didn't have a baby. She'd stopped going into her office, preferring to spend a few desultory hours at the computer before taking a long afternoon nap. She was bored. She was ready. She was beyond ready. Downstairs, Tommy was hammering. She still couldn't believe the change that had come over him once he got that ridiculous artifact out of his apartment. The day Tommy collapsed on the stoop, EMS declared him fine. Exhausted and dehydrated, but fine. When they finally got him inside and she saw the statue, she'd nearly fainted herself. She knew all about the theft at Ground Zero because one of her clients had written an entire book about the recovery efforts downtown and was currently covering the rebuilding of the new Freedom Tower. Logistics of statue moving aside, the transfer was absurdly simple. Stephanie asked her old friend Will to help, knowing she could trust him to protect Tommy. A rented truck, a late-night drop-off at a collection spot that had been set up for anyone wanting to donate 9/11 artifacts. Ever since the statue had been returned to its rightful place, Tommy had taken to his living quarters with a new zeal, renovating the entire garden level himself. It was going to be beautiful. 5 days late, Stephanie had taken her nap, refolded the baby blankets in the spanking new crib in the pretty new nursery. The July heat was blistering, and the afternoons were too miserable to do anything but sit in her air-conditioned living room, watch reality TV, and saunter down the block for an overpriced gelato before dinner. Standing in front of a neighboring stoop, listlessly rummaging through a pile of books left out for the taking, she felt a little pop, like a balloon bursting quietly and deep inside. And then the telltale gush between her legs, followed by a long, throbbing ache, longer and heavier than the small pre-contractions she'd been having. She leaned against a neighbor's stone balustrade with one hand and took a deep breath. She felt the sweat trickle down the back of her neck, between her tender breasts. She closed her eyes and the sun beat down on her face and shoulders and arms, the peach gelato in her other hand dripping down her palm and wrist. She wanted to remember this moment. She looked at the wet spot on the pavement and thought, "This is before." The trickle down her inner thighs, the swelling ache at her back, they were ushering her to a completely different place. To after. She was ready. As she stood, mesmerized by her amniotic fluid meandering down the slope of the bluestone sidewalk, the first and last moment, as it would happen, that she had the luxury of observing the process with any aplomb, the first contraction hit, and was so sustained it took her breath away, doubled her over, and she was stunned to hear herself audibly groan. "Okay," she thought, "I guess this is going to be fucking intense." As the pain receded and she tried to catch her breath and move toward her house, another contraction, right on the heels of the first, and this one, she didn't even know how it was possible that she registered it, but she did, a little stronger and longer than the first. As the second contraction subsided, she stood and waited. Nothing. She took the phone out of her pocket and hit the stopwatch function so she could time the intervals between contractions. Everything was happening too fast. Gingerly, she started to walk, and when she was directly in front of Tommy's living room windows, the third contraction, she grabbed onto the wrought iron railing with both hands, and the sound that came out of her was so primal and involuntary that she scared herself. She felt as if she were being torn in two. Tommy loved telling this part of the story, how he heard her before he saw her. "Three kids," he'd say, "I knew that sound. Oh boy, did I know that sound." He ran out the front door and managed to get Stephanie up the stairs and through the front door, contractions 4 and 5. He tried to settle her on the floor, contraction 6. "Not on the rug," she'd screamed at him. He'd run upstairs to grab some sheets out of the linen closet and a blanket to wrap the baby because it was evident that there would be no time to get to the hospital. A pair of scissors from the bathroom? Peroxide? Why not? He started toward her bedroom, thinking he could use a few pillows when he heard her bellowing. Downstairs, Stephanie was just trying to control her breathing. Shit. Why hadn't she paid more attention to the breathing? Practiced. She couldn't manage her breathing. Couldn't get ahead of the pain. She sat on the living room floor, pulled out her phone, and after a brief, unsettling conversation with her doctor, during which she had two contractions, and the doctor said, "I'm hanging up and sending an ambulance." And before she could even check the time again, and she knew this was very wrong, way too soon, she had to push. "Tommy," she wailed up to him, "where was he? I have to push." "No, no, no," he yelled down to her. "No pushing, absolutely no pushing." But telling her not to push was like telling her not to breathe. Her body was pushing. Her body wouldn't not push. She reached up from the floor and pulled a cashmere blanket off the back of the sofa. She could hear sirens, but it was too soon for her ambulance, and she knew she wasn't going anywhere. She tried to remember if she'd learned anything about what to do once the baby was out. Would she have to cut the cord? Oh, God. The afterbirth? What the fuck was she going to do? The contractions were seamless. A constant tsunami of pressure. There was no break. No moment when she didn't feel like every internal organ was trying to exit her body in one concerted rush. She pulled up her maternity skirt, managed to work her underpants off, and placed the cashmere blanket next to her on the floor. "Nothing but the best for baby," she thought, hoping she would remember later that she'd had the presence of mind to make a tiny joke. She was trying to fight the urge to push. But she knew she'd already lost. Her body was doing what it needed to do, and it was completely clear that her job was to surrender. Tommy had come down the stairs and dumped a pile of things near her head and was in the kitchen washing his hands. At least she thought that's what he was doing. She'd lost count of the contractions. She'd lost track of time. She thought she could feel something emerging. But how could that be true? It couldn't be true. She remembered she was supposed to be trying short little breaths. Ha, 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 ha. No use. She reached down between her legs and felt it. Her daughter's head. Slick and wet and grainy with hair. Her daughter was in a hurry. "Tommy," she yelled into the kitchen. "She's coming." Her daughter was here. Chapter 45. There were three things Paul Underwood assiduously avoided. The beach, watercraft, and so-called street food. He genuinely disliked the beach, enjoyed neither the sand nor the beating sun nor the occasional whiff of putrefying sea creatures, nor the practically prehensile barnacles cleaving to a twist of brown, otherworldly, goose-fleshed kelp. He made certain exceptions. On a cool, cloudy day, preferably in winter, preferably with an offshore breeze, he could be persuaded to walk along the waterfront for atmosphere if, say, a bowl of chowder or a bucket of steamers were offered as recompense at the end. But otherwise? Thank you very much, but no thank you. He'd never learned to swim, and marine vessels of any kind, from kayaks to cruise ships, petrified him. He'd never even learned to drive a car, so the prospect of a stalled boat was also disturbing. And the entire concept of street food was befuddling and abhorrent. The greasy cart with its questionable sanitation. The paper plates that lost all tensile strength before you were finished, eating while standing, having things drip down your hand or onto your pants, and how to accommodate a beverage along with flatware and napkins. He didn't even approve of dining al fresco. What was the point when there was a perfectly wonderful, bug-free, climate-controlled room nearby? Street food was dining al fresco minus the petty luxuries of a table and a chair. In other words, minus civilization. So Paul's discomfort, while standing on a slightly swaying dock under the relentless afternoon Caribbean sun, waiting to board a ferry while eating a plate of jerk chicken and fried plantains served from a truck in confounding proximity to the diesel fumes from the nearby idling ferry, was immense. Immense and vaguely nauseating. His consolation? B. She was across the dock, sitting on a bench, her face bent to her plate of food and momentarily hidden by the wide-brimmed straw hat he'd bought her the minute they arrived at the ferry terminal from the airport 10 days ago. Although their trip hadn't been successful by Bee's measure, she hadn't found Leo, the trip for Paul had gone exceedingly well. Bee's spirits had oddly, or maybe predictably, risen a bit each day. Partly it was their surroundings, being away from New York, being away from the Plums. But partly it was because Bee seemed to let go a little bit more each day of the need to find Leo. It wasn't anything she said. She wouldn't talk about not finding Leo. But her dissipating urgency was obvious to Paul. Her brow seemed to smooth a little each day, her shoulders unwound. She'd stopped chewing the side of her mouth. Everyone else seemed convinced that Bee was on a fool's errand. Well, if that made him the fool's accomplice, so be it. He'd eagerly volunteered to accompany Bee when she confided how anxious she was about going alone. And not just for the opportunity of her company or to offer support for her fraught mission, but to be there to help her confront Leo if he actually appeared. Paul would be quite happy to confront Leo. He enjoyed parts of their trip, especially the tiny side-by-side but separate wooden cottages they rented near the water, both with green tile roofs and cherry-colored bougainvillea surrounding the front doors. He appreciated the expansive view of the shimmering blue water that he could admire safely from his shaded deck. And the trip had begun with promise. An airport worker recognized Leo's photo as someone who'd landed on a small charter from Miami some weeks ago and who hadn't left, at least not by plane. But after that initial hopeful sign, nothing. Nobody recognized his photo, or, as Paul strongly suspected was the case, they did and didn't say so. As Bee became increasingly frustrated, he started going out on his own some afternoons, looking in the more remote bars on the island, the places not frequented by tourists, and, Paul believed, not appropriate for Bee. But those efforts ran dry, too. 2 nights ago, he'd coaxed her out for dinner at a small inn on the island. He took her hand in his and made his case for returning to New York. That's as far as his physical intrusion went. She was preoccupied with Leo, occasionally despondent, and he didn't want her to turn to him out of sadness or desperation. He'd waited this long. He could wait until they got back to New York. Or he could wait for her to make the first move. They'd been so simpatico lately that he thought he wasn't crazy in believing she might just make the first move. And she'd been writing nearly every day. Clickety-clack, clickety-clack. He could hear her from his desk when the door to her room was open, typing on the keyboard. She demurred when he asked what she was working on, but he could tell she was pleased. And he was patient. If Paul Underwood was anything, he was extremely patient. Then this morning, she'd excitedly knocked on his door before breakfast. She was talking so fast he didn't understand her at first. She'd sent 50 pages of something new to Stephanie, she told him. More Archie? No, no, she said, shaking her head vigorously. No Archie. No more freaking Archie. Something else. I don't even know what it is yet, but listen. B read from Stephanie's email, lavish with praise for the pages and ending with, "Keep going, I love this, I can sell it." And just like that, B was ready to go home. They'd slipped some cash to a local police officer asking him to keep his eyes open for Leo. They packed their things and booked their flights. They were waiting for the ferry to take them to the larger island's airport. Paul walked over to Bea as she stood and tossed her empty plate of mediocre food in a nearby trash can. He had a headache. "I'm going to go across the street to look for aspirin," he said. "I'll be right back." He walked over to the small gas station and accompanying rickety wooden building that sold mechanical parts and a smattering of groceries and other sundries. Flanking the doors were two small stands with boxes of mangoes in various states of ripening, swarms of fruit flies hovering over each crate. Inside, Paul went to grab the guava soda B liked. He could hear a lively crowd in a side room, a bunch of men laughing. He smelled weed. Paul heard Leo before he saw him, recognized the barking laugh that was distinctly Leo's. He told himself he was just imagining things, that they'd spent so many hours of so many days looking for Leo that he was constituting him out of thin air in the very last minutes before boarding the ferry. But then he heard the laugh again, closer, and the man with the laugh was heading to a rear restroom. Paul ducked behind a cardboard display for Kodak film that had to be at least 20 years old, two life-size all-American teens holding tennis rackets and laughing. The sun had faded all the pigment on the display to various shades of blue, so the models looked ghostly, in spite of their jauntily cocked elbows and toothy smiles. From his spot behind the display, he saw the back of the laugher's head, took in his height, his hair, the particular profile that was, absolutely and beyond any doubt, Leo Plum. He'd found Leo. Later, Paul would tell himself he hesitated that afternoon in the bodega because he'd had too much sun, or that it was the jerk chicken that was already roiling his stomach with ill portent given that they were about to get on a ferry and then a small plane to Miami and then a bigger plane to New York. Or shock. Sheer shock. He'd never really expected to find Leo. He hurriedly paid for the soda and a tiny bottle of baby aspirin, which was all they had. As he made his way across the street, he thought about what to tell B. Back at the ferry terminal, he found a bit of shade at the side of the building and stopped to think for a minute. Seeing Leo again made Paul realize how much he loathed him. Nathan had told Paul about Leo's undermining tactics, how he'd questioned Paul's leadership and competence. Paul had been furious, but he also recognized that Leo's misstep had angered Nathan enough to tip the scale in Paul's favor. The first influx of Nathan's funding had already arrived, and Paul was working night and day to prove to Nathan that he'd made the right choice. From afar, he could see B, still sitting where he'd left her. The straw hat was on the bench beside her. She was getting too much sun. She was wearing the old yellow dress he remembered from her first speakeasy photo, the picture he'd chosen for the cover, a decision that somehow ended up being credited to Leo. Like then, her face was in profile, her expression undimmed, hopeful. He walked over and handed her the drink. "Nice and cold," she said, holding the bottle with two hands and putting it to her cheek. "What?" she said, looking up at his face. "What's wrong?" "Nothing," he said, attempting to clear whatever was clouding his expression. "I was just thinking that you look really happy right now." His heart galloped, knowing what he knew and what he wanted to do with what he knew. "I am kind of happy," she said, sounding surprised. Their ferry had arrived, and its disembarking passengers streamed out onto the dock. "Are you ready?" Paul offered his hand to B, and in that moment he did a quick calculation. Who was B with Leo, and who might she be without him? Who might he be without Leo in the picture? Who might they be together? B placed her palm in Paul's hand and stood to face him, and his answer was as clear as the easy, radiant expression on her face, which was, even given the beating sun and the smell of street food and the stink of the ocean nearby, positively transporting. Beatific. Exhilarating and emollient.
When Bea placed her hand in Paul's, she felt an unexpected rush. It was nice. He'd been so patient, so good, so helpful and loyal and true. His ordinarily pale skin had an almost pretty glow from the sun. In spite of his incessant application of sunscreen with an SPF factor at or above 70, she'd badgered him into wearing a t-shirt, and true, it was solid navy and topped with a seersucker jacket. But he still looked different to her somehow. Taller, more confident. As she stood and faced him, she saw something determined move across his face. Something, she could tell, having to do with her, and that made her feel safe. Calm. He was, she realized, nearly handsome. He had been deeply disappointed when she decided to put the last Archie story into a desk drawer. For good. It's not mine, she told him. It belongs to Leo and Matilda and someone who hasn't even been born yet. It's not the story I need to tell. And still, he'd been so stalwart about helping her look for Leo. She knew he'd even gone off on his own a few times.
I liked this place, she said to him. In spite of everything.
I liked it too, he said. They stood there, her hand in his, both of them looking a little giddy and a little tentative and a little sun-kissed and a little sweaty. And though she didn't understand the heady optimism moving through her, she hoped it was her new work, but maybe it was just the sway of the dock, the swell of the water. Paul? She decided to embrace it. To bear her own joy.
Do you know what else I like? She said, putting a hand on each of Paul Underwood's shoulders.
From his usual chair at the regular Friday morning bodega card game, the one facing the door, Leo had seen Paul the minute he crossed over to the drink cooler. He'd moved off to the side of the room and tried to stay calm while wondering what to do. The guys he was playing with would cover for him. He wouldn't have to explain, just tell them that Underwood was trouble and they'd clam right up. He made his way to the restroom out back and locked the door behind him, wanting to think for a minute where Paul couldn't ambush him. There were advantages to running, of course, but he was also curious, wondered who was with Paul. B, that seemed obvious. Paul and B had to be waiting for the 5:15 p.m. ferry, which was always at least 15 minutes late. He wondered if anyone else had come looking for him. He had time to sneak over to the terminal and see who else was there. Melody, maybe? Stephanie? Or he could just walk up to Paul and ask. Man to man. Man to half man. Man to underdog. Whatever. His siblings could find him, but they couldn't force him to do anything. He'd kind of been expecting this moment. Truthfully, he was surprised it took so long. Technically, he should have been in South Vietnam right now, but he'd gotten a little lazy. He splashed his face with some questionable water from the sink marked non-potable and stepped back into the bodega. Paul Underwood was nowhere in sight. Had he not seen Leo? Leo was sure he had. Paul never did have a poker face. Leo decided to investigate. Across the street, from a spot inside the tiny terminal building, he saw B sitting on the outside pier right away. Even in a crowd of American tourists, her clothes were ridiculously colorful. She was sitting on a bench, her legs out in front of her. Her gold sandals caught the sun. A tall woman stood next to B. Her back was to Leo, but he would know that long red hair anywhere. Stephanie. He quickly moved toward the open doorway, and right before he crossed the threshold, the redhead turned toward Leo and he stopped. It wasn't Stephanie, not even close. This woman was too heavy and her face was sunburned and pudgy, almost pig-like. He felt a surge of fury for this stranger who dared to look from behind like someone he now realized he'd been expecting to see.
She hadn't come. As the ferry docked and started unloading its passengers, a few local teens began to play the steel drums, hoping to be the first recipients of the newly arrived tourists' dollars. Leo watched Bee stand and say something to Paul that made him smile as she lazily dropped her arms over his shoulders. Even from a distance, Leo swore he could see Paul blush. "Come on, underdog," Leo found himself silently coaxing. "Grow a pair." Paul slid one hand along Bee's waist and pulled her closer, ran a finger along the line of her jaw, and then cupped her face with his hand. Right there, right in that moment, Leo watched Bee surrender. Exhale. He watched her knees collapse a bit and her elbows bend as she leaned into Paul, and then they were kissing. As if they were alone. As if they were in love. As if for all time. After the long and heady kiss, Bee hadn't ever expected to be kissed like that again in her entire life, not after Tucker died. She and Paul stood quietly for a minute, in a close embrace. Everyone was boarding the ferry now. Her eyes were still closed, and she could feel how neatly her body aligned with Paul's. How her tidy breasts matched up with his narrow chest. How his slight potbelly fit perfectly into her slender middle. And how her chin fit just so into the crook of his shoulder. She drew back, wanting to see his face. But as she lifted her gaze, a familiar profile caught her eye. A stream of people temporarily blocked her line of sight, but when they passed, she could see the figure walking toward her. The lowering, late-afternoon sun shone straight into her eyes, and the glare made everything hazy, including the man, who was nearly a shadow. She froze. It couldn't be. When Leo started toward Bee, he had no plan, no idea what he was going to say. He just impulsively moved in her direction. When she raised her head and saw him, he stopped. As he hesitated, he watched everything about her change. She stiffened. Her face went dark with worry and confusion. She closed her eyes and lowered her chin. "Breathe," Bee told herself. "Just breathe." She remained perfectly still, afraid to move or look up, waiting to hear his voice calling her name. Afraid to hear his voice calling her name. Paul held her a little tighter. He smelled like shampoo and sunscreen and faintly of jerk chicken. A nearby seagull squawked, sounding as if it were laughing. The ferry horn blared three times. Final boarding. "Ready?" Paul said. She lifted her head and blinked a little. The figure was gone. She looked again, shielding her eyes. No one. She thought she'd seen Leo 1,000 times on this trip, 1,000,000 times every day, sometimes every hour. She thought she'd seen him dancing to a calypso band at their hotel, serving fish to a nearby table at a restaurant, and buying mangoes at the side of the road. She thought she'd seen him walking down the beach, flip-flops in hand, in the backseat of a taxi weaving through traffic, playing pool through an open door, on countless bar stools and down countless sun-drenched alleys under the swaying palms. But it had never been him. It had never been Leo. "I'm ready," she said, retrieving her hat from the bench, placing her straw bag on her shoulder. "Let's go home." Epilogue. 1 year later. The day of the baby's first birthday was every bit as muggy and miserable as the day of her birth. That's what everyone said to Stephanie when they arrived at the celebratory lunch. Remember? It was a day exactly like this. As if it had happened decades or centuries ago. Not 52 measly weeks and their meteorological recall was something magical and marvelous. "Oh, I remember," Stephanie said. How could she forget? The heat, the ice cream melting down her arm, the onset of a labor so sudden and fierce that it had a name, precipitate labor. Lillian Plum Palmer, called Lila for short. Her first name was a sweet secret to Stephanie, just between her and her mantle. Was born in her mother's living room exactly 42 minutes after Stephanie's water broke. She slid into Tommy's hands as the paramedics were ringing the front doorbell. "It's a girl! It's a girl!" Tommy said over and over, forgetting that Stephanie knew she was having a girl, but remembering all three times the doctor had delivered the same joyful news to him as he clutched Ronnie's hand after the final agonizing push. And today, Lila was one. In spite of the heat, Stephanie was setting up in the yard. It wouldn't be too bad. She'd expressly asked everyone not to bring a gift. Lila'd never had a birthday before, and she wouldn't know the difference, and Stephanie didn't want more junk in her house. But she knew the request was pointless, and, sure enough, as the plums arrived, most of them not only brought a gift, they were laden with gifts. Melody and Walt arrived first. Louisa had recently moved into Stephanie's second bedroom and was preparing for the upcoming school year when she'd be studying art at Pratt, just one neighborhood over. She'd gotten a generous scholarship, but not enough to cover room and board. When Stephanie heard she was thinking of commuting into Brooklyn every day, she offered Louisa a free room in exchange for the occasional weeknight or weekend babysitting. They'd only been living together for a week, but Stephanie was surprised by how much she enjoyed Louisa's company, and Lila was crazy about her big girl cousins. Louisa and Nora, when she visited, were so good with her, happy to swing her back and forth between them as they walked the length of the yard again and again, willing to sit and amuse her with silly voices or by building towers with colorful foam blocks. Nora had brought her friend Simone today, and as Stephanie and Melody stood at the kitchen window watching the girls with Lila out beneath the newly planted maple, they saw Simone lean in and give Nora a quick kiss.
"I won't lie. It's a little weird," Melody said. Her tone was affectionate, if a little melancholy.
"Do you like her?" Stephanie asked.
"Simone?" Melody said. "I guess. She's intense. I don't know what's going to happen when she's at Brown and Nora moves to Buffalo." It would be State College for Nora after all. "I kind of hope they do stay in touch. Simone pressured Nora all year to work harder. It's the reason she got into the Honors College."
"Love can be an excellent motivator," Stephanie said.
"When it doesn't wreck your heart," Melody wanted to say. But that would have been cruel, so she didn't.
And Melody had to admit, Stephanie's post-Leo life seemed far from wrecked. She seemed happy. The doorbell rang, Jack, Bea, and Paul all arriving. More presents and ribbons and passing around of Lila, who pulled so insistently at the collar of her party dress that Stephanie took it off, and soon Lila was toddling around the backyard in a soggy diaper, red-faced and sweaty. She was wild-eyed and overstimulated, and they hadn't even given her any sugar yet. Stephanie knew she'd never go down for a nap later. Oh, well. Out back, Jack was hoping to find a bit of shade. The new tree Stephanie planted to replace the one felled during the storm was small. Jack thought she should have splurged a little to buy one that was more mature. He pulled a chair close to the trunk where it was marginally cooler. Years later, when the tree had grown and formed the perfect canopy over the rear of the yard, Lila would marry beneath the massive leafy boughs turning red and orange on a blindingly beautiful October afternoon. She would ask Jack to escort her down the leaf-strewn path to her partner. Jack would be good to Lila all her life, showing up whenever she was missing a father. On the day of her wedding, when Lila appeared on Jack's almost 70-year-old arm, Stephanie would see Leo at her side, and for a debilitating moment would be crushed by the enormity of everything he'd missed. Now, sitting under the tree, keeping an eye on Lila in case she moved too fast and fell, she was still a little unsteady on her feet, Jack was also wishing for Walker, albeit with more melancholy than grief these days. Walker was the only person he could think of who would actually look forward to a baby's birthday party. He'd heard from his old friend Arthur that Walker was already living with somebody new, and in a way it was nice to learn that, ultimately, Walker had been the one who wasn't good at being alone. Jack was more relieved than surprised to find how very good he was at living alone. He'd fall in love many more times in his life, but he would never want another man to share his home. B was corralling the group, insisting that Lila open gifts. She was crazy about Lila, but she really wanted the party to be over so she could get home and back to work. She was more than halfway through her novel about an artist who has stopped painting and then, through a series of losses and loves, as she pitched to Stephanie, finds her way back to herself and her art. It wasn't quite autobiographical, but whatever B had loosened by turning her lens away from Leo and onto herself made it all work. Every time Stephanie got new chapters, they were better than the ones that came before. B didn't know the ending of the book yet, but she knew if she kept working, she'd find it. She knew it was in front of her. "I always knew you had this in you," Stephanie told her, thrilled and relieved not to be reading about a thinly disguised Leo. She couldn't have done it. After much urging on Paul's part, B had finally sold her apartment, put the money in the bank, and moved in with Paul. She was writing full-time. She'd brought at least 5 gifts for Lila. Stephanie put Lila on her lap and let her tear pieces of wrapping paper into tiny bits while B tried to interest her in the parade of presents. The little red fire engine with wheels that Lila could sit on and ride down the sidewalk, propelling herself forward with her meaty legs. A teddy bear twice her size that briefly made her cry. 3 Marimekko dresses bought at a fancy baby boutique that would make Lila look like a mini bee. A multicolored plastic monstrosity called Baby's First Smartphone from Melody. Stephanie would take the phone and most of the other needless toys to Goodwill the following Monday. An exquisite tiny antique bracelet from Jack. Pink gold with inlaid chips of ruby, Lila's birthstone. "What a remarkably beautiful choking hazard," Melody joked as Stephanie tried to get Lila to sit still long enough to clip it around her chubby wrist. No dice. After the presents were opened and the wrappings collected and lunch was served, they all gathered around the table in the yard and sat Lila at the head in her high chair. Lila tugged at the elastic from the sparkly party hat Melody had put on her head. She finally pulled the hat loose and flung it to the ground, legs swinging, feet banging against the rungs of the chair. She started squirming to be let down, but when a cupcake with an unlit candle was placed in front of her, and everyone started singing happy birthday, she quieted and stared at the joyful, looming faces above her. Stephanie knew what everyone was doing while Lila offered a rare, still moment to search her resplendent face. They were looking for Leo. It was impossible not to see Leo in Lila. The way her bright eyes would narrow when she was angry. Her pointed chin was his, as was her broad forehead. The elegant tapered eyebrows and overbearing mouth, all sitting below bright red curls just like Stephanie's. Leo was gone, but he was right there in front of them. And as they concluded their off-key warbling and started to cheer, Lila looked up and shyly smiled and applauded herself. "Throw a kiss, Lila," Louisa said, wanting to show off the trick she'd taught her cousin that week. Lila brought her fleshy, sticky palm to her mouth and then flung an imaginary kiss to the crowd. She squealed as everyone pretended to catch it and threw one again and again, flinging kisses to the left and to the right, until suddenly it was too much. Spent, she rubbed her eyes, her face crumpled. Then she raised both arms high. "Up," she said, looking desperately from one eager face to another. "Up." She opened and closed both hands as if she were grabbing fistfuls of air. "Up," she said again, as her family rushed toward her all at once, each of them hoping to get to her first.
This is Mia Barron. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Nest by Cynthia Dupree Sweeney. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. The director was Peter Straub. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2016 by Cynthia Dupree Sweeney. Production copyright 2016 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.